Welcome to Crypto Nights, where we help you finally make sense of the trending world of cryptocurrencies. So gather your virtual piggy bank and let's get started.
Welcome to the next episode of Crypto Nights, where the best minds bridge the crypto divide. I'm your host, Kanth Miriala. My usual disclaimer, these are for educational purposes only, not a solicitation, nor an endorsement for investment. You do so at your sole discretion. We suggest you do your due diligence. We are not financial advisors. Tokens are highly risky and you could lose all of your invested money. With that, let me come back to the most exciting stuff of today. My guest for this episode is Daniel Rice. Daniel is the CTO and co-founder of Bootstrap Legal, a platform for real estate entrepreneurs to get fundraising legal paperwork done. He also has been a software engineer, a leader, a speaker, and a writer with expertise in blockchain and finance, and helped launch over 20 products. As an entrepreneur, his personal apps have racked up over 5 million downloads. Coming back to Bootstrap Legal, it was founded and built by a former attorney who believed that small business entrepreneurs are the drivers of innovation and job creation. Yet, they often lack affordable access to quality legal counsel. They are building tools to fix this problem. Now, without any further ado, let's welcome Dan Rice. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for coming and thank you for your time as well. We are very excited about today's topic, and I think that's something very appropriate given what's been happening. Why don't we start off by me jumping in and talking to you about a little bit about your interests specifically, you know, around the security. And you mentioned that smart contracts, not too many people may know about it, and not too many people may know how to handle them carefully. So how do we make smart contracts safer for others, for everyone out there?
Sure. First of all, let me just tell you a little bit about my background and why that's important. So I actually spent the first half of my computer science career working at a company where I was doing, several companies where I was doing kernel development and kernel drivers for Windows, Mac, and sometimes Linux too. And so security was just paramount to everything we were doing. And so when Bitcoin came about, I was very interested in it because there are some major security ramifications. But on top of that, there are, you know, smart contract systems that have been developed since then. Ethereum is kind of what they call blockchain 2.0. So it's taking Bitcoin and saying, well, you can actually do more than this. You can have a whole programming language that's Turing complete sitting on top of the blockchain, and you can create contracts that way that are immutable and can't be stopped once they're programmed. And so that introduces a whole set of security vulnerabilities, going back to one of the tenets of computer science, which is just in general, when you have more complex systems, there's more chance of there being issues with it, with flaws in it, because even with, there are systems out there where you can kind of look for issues that would, some like formalized static analysis of code and that kind of stuff. Those become very limiting, and or they don't work as well when it's a very complex system. And so when you take Ethereum and you basically bolt it on top of what was there from Bitcoin, you end up with a very complex system. And I think initially I was very skeptical because of my background that Ethereum would work, because there's going to be a lot of attack vectors for someone who's maliciously minded to get in and steal funds. And what we know from cryptocurrency in general is that it's a little bit different than what everyone's used to. And what that means, what I mean by that is, you know, normally if you lose your money, let's say you lose your password to your bank account, in general, if that happens, if someone gets in your bank account and tries to transfer your money, your bank's going to call you, or you're going to call them and say, someone moved my money. And they're most likely, in most instances, I have heard the instances where it's not the case, but in a lot of instances, they'll give you your money back because they'll be able to get the money back from wherever it went if you respond quick enough. Cryptocurrency, it's completely different. It's something that's called a bearer instrument. So if you have the private keys to some money on Bitcoin or Ethereum or another cryptocurrency's network, then most likely you have control of that money, and there's no name associated with it. There's no one to call if you actually, you know, forget your key or don't write it down or someone else got in and transferred it out. Guess what? You just lost it. And bearer instruments aren't new, but they're not something that we use regularly. I mean, there are certain types that we do that we don't think about as assets, but generally the assets that we use are totally different than that. They're registered with your bank. If it's a stock, even normally when you're trading stocks, you're not even really trading stocks. You're trading IOUs for stocks, and someone else is storing those stocks so that they won't get lost. So fundamentally, as a user, you have to look at this a little different than anything that you normally experience. You have much more responsibility, and that responsibility is to make sure that your systems are secure, make sure that no one else even got a picture of your private keys, because that's enough to steal your money in a lot of cases. So yeah, I mean, in general, security is very important, and the usability cases around it as a user are very different, and you just need to educate yourself if you're going to use it.
Exactly, exactly. And just so people understand, these kind, what are the challenges of smart contracts? What are the security loopholes or flaws that have resulted in loss of money? Are there examples? Can we motivate our listeners to pay attention to this, because, you know, bad things have happened in the past?
Yeah, that's a good question. So since Ethereum launched, I think just year over year, we've probably seen some announcements about big hacks or things that have gone wrong on the network and money's been lost. And in the last kind of year and a half, we've seen a lot of money, like hundreds of millions of dollars, get either locked up or lost on the network. One instance that I could talk about that just happened recently is this Parity wallet issue. So a few weeks ago, there was an issue where there's a common wallet that's ironically supposed to be the most secure way, or one of the most secure ways, to store your Ether, which is the currency on Ethereum. It's supposed to be the best way to store it because it uses something called multi-signature, which is generally considered to be a safe way to store your cryptocurrency. And the idea behind multi-signature is, instead of just requiring one private key or one password, as it could be described, to unlock funds, you actually have multiple keys, and you say, okay, well, there's five keys and we need three of them at any time. It's kind of like we see with your bank account. If you have an account where, oh, it's not just my signature, I need my wife's signature too. We need both signatures to unlock things from this account. Bank accounts can have that feature. So similarly, cryptocurrency wallets can have that feature. So what happened with the Ethereum network is that there was a bug in this smart contract that facilitated this wallet for the users. And turned out that it wasn't so much that someone could steal funds from, there may have been a way to steal funds, but what actually happened is that somebody killed a shared library that was used for it. And in essence, all the money that was used by that wallet, by everyone who was using it after a certain date, got locked up. And we can see on the network, it hasn't been stolen. It's just irretrievable. So it's an important thing to consider. It's not necessarily just theft you have to worry about. It's just, are you going to lose your money? So in this case, we can see, because the blockchain is a ledger that anyone can view, we can see that the money is still all sitting there, but no one can access it because the smart contract that was needed to access it has been destroyed, and it can't be recreated without the entire network agreeing to fork it, and et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of questions about what's going to happen now because it's such a significant chunk of money. But we're entering this world where, so the way I like to think about it is, contracts have been around for thousands of years. They're a natural human construct. I can make a contract on a bar napkin. We call that an informal contract. I can do a verbal contract. And actually, those can all be binding contracts. But there's obviously a lot that a bar napkin isn't going to say about what the terms of the contract are that would make it confusing in a court of law about what was really meant by that. And so that's where traditional formal contracts come from, is, you know, people who looked at that and said, well, I can raise issue with this and that that isn't mentioned on the bar napkin. Say, for example, this bar napkin, if it's a contract about buying a boat, it doesn't say what would happen if the boat breaks in the first week or something like that. So after that, basically what happened is this case law started to get developed. And so traditional contracts come from a place of, can we write in everything that we might need in case this issue comes up, which has come up before, or this issue comes up. So I think what ends up happening is you have this massive text contract, and that's the contracts that we generally sign today when we're getting a credit card or doing anything that's not between just a couple friends making a contract. And we call that traditional contract. Well, now we have this new kind of contract that's called a smart contract. And a smart contract is executable code. And the significant thing about it is that it can't be stopped. So if I make a contract with someone I don't even know, and we fund the contract together, that this is what we're going to do. Say it's, oh, you know, if it rains Friday, I'm going to give you $5. Well, if that goes into effect and the contract has the right information, I can't stop it from paying out the money that I agreed to pay out, or the other party in the contract can't stop it. And so that's really cool, but it also has a lot of dangers to it. For example, if I make a contract with myself and I say, mail myself money in 2 weeks and I'm going to give myself $20. Well, if I accidentally code it up to be 2 months instead of 2 weeks, I can't get out of that. And I'm going to have to wait 2 months to get those funds. And that's easy because it's only 2 months. But what if I accidentally did it for 2,000 years because I used the wrong, you know, type of digits or something? Then that could be, I can't get out of that contract because the smart contract executes how it's going to execute. And no one can stop it, even the creator in a lot of cases. So basically, it's very rigid. But and there's huge value in that, but maybe too rigid in some cases. And if, unfortunately, less than 1% of the population knows how to program, less than 1% of the population is an attorney. So you have these two separate kinds of contracts, smart contracts, traditional contracts, and still most people aren't really able to use them super effectively. So if you're thinking about using blockchain smart contracts, you know, knowing people, if you don't program other people who will be able to look over contracts is important. And beyond that, I could tell you about what we're doing as a company. I don't know if we want to get into that now, but we're trying to bridge that gap.
Please do. I do want. So just as a something that you reminded me of is being a programmer in the past myself, you know, I think it was Donald Knuth who said that testing always shows the presence of bugs, never their absence. So we take very fallible human beings that use programming languages to code something that are fraught with errors called bugs, and now we freeze them to eternity. Seems to be an inherently risky thing to do.
So, yeah, so there is, like I said, some development in the space to push towards systems that can formally verify contracts, but that only works for really simple examples. And what my co-founder always likes to say as an attorney is, you can have the best law firm in the world, and you can have 10 partners at that law firm review your contract, and in the end, it's still going to be imperfect. Likewise, if you have the best programmers in the world and they write a contract for you, it's going to have flaws. And even if it doesn't, there are external factors that can affect the contract. You could just, all parties of a contract could decide they want to terminate the contract early. Well, you may not be able to do that with a smart contract unless you wrote the code in. There could be an external data source that you're using. Say it's, you know, like the example I gave about rain. What if you were getting information from a certain data feed and it gave the wrong information to your contract? Because your contract actually doesn't know what the weather is. So there are all, and then there's gray areas in a contract. And that's really where the majority of lawsuits exist in traditional contracts is, well, I know the contract said, you know, 14 days, but, you know, it was a leap year and it wasn't really 14 days or whatever. You know, there's all these things that could happen in a traditional contract that are what people go to court about, where it's unclear who was right and who was wrong. And so coding all those up, we've seen with traditional contracts isn't really popular. I mean, or it's not really possible. And with smart contracts, it's even harder, because the thing about a coded contract from a computer is it doesn't understand gray at all. So, you know, you're just very limited in what you can tell it to do. And therefore, you know, there's going to be more things that fall out of it where there are holes in the code. And in those cases, you're going to need a way to dispute those contracts. And that's what we're doing as a company. So
yeah, I think now is a great time to segue into what you do. So I know that we have listed some of the flaws, not necessarily all of the flaws that a smart contract has inherently, and that's not the purpose. We just want to, you know, alert people enough to say, hey, this is exciting technology, but also pretty dangerous to handle. So yeah, can you start shedding some light on what you're doing at Bootstrap Legal?
Yeah, so I mean, we're a company that's focused on democratizing access to legal services. And we think that blockchain technology and smart contracts is absolutely the way to do that, in spite of the fact that there are all these concerns right now. But we're very early. We're like in the early stages of the internet, as an analogy of where we're at with this kind of stuff. So a lot of it hasn't been explored or even solved. And it's a giant experiment to figure things out. But I think the important thing for us and where we're coming from, and my co-founder is, like I said, a securities attorney with a background in crowdfunding. So our thing is, a lot of it, you know, we can't pretend like we need to reinvent the wheel. There are a lot of these legal systems that people don't like today, or they, you know, have a problem with our legal system. A lot of the legal system and other things that exist around it were created out of necessity. And so what we're looking at is, and normally with contracts, there's something called dispute resolution, and that's when things go wrong with a contract. Normally with a contract, or probably most contracts, nothing really goes wrong of note, and the contract terminates and no one ever thinks about it again. But when something goes wrong, that's when everything in the contract starts mattering a whole lot. And not only what's in the contract, but what wasn't in the contract and what the intent of the contract was. And that's what we were looking at as a company, because when we looked at, there was a really big loss of money on the Ethereum network last year through something called the DAO. And the DAO was this large contract that allowed people to run an autonomous organization, essentially. And the idea was that everyone who invests in it will be able to vote on what the corporation does. And it didn't really have a certain specific purpose, but ultimately it was supposed to be an investment vehicle in some ways, where over time the DAO would collect more money by making good decisions. That was the general concept about it. What ended up happening was that there was a way in the contract that someone could extract all the funds from it instantly, pretty much. There was some escrow limitations. And so what happened is someone did extract a whole bunch of the money, but it was held in an escrow. And during that time, the entire network said, hey, this is going to be too much loss of funds. Let's go back and like pretend this never happened, kind of, and let's change the network fundamentally so that it's gone. So we looked at that and we said, well, basically mob mentality replaced a legal system in that case for handling the dispute. And that may have worked somewhat in that case, although there was some splintering things that came out of it and factions started. And there's another coin called Ethereum Classic that was developed out of it. It turns out that's just not a scalable solution, because there were other instances where people lost money because I have a friend who lost Ether because he sent it to an address that doesn't exist. I mean, there's lots of reasons why you could lose money on the network, and not everyone got their money back. Just that one particular contract, there was enough people involved that they got their money back. And it kind of was reminiscent to people of the real estate bailouts that happened. And the problem with that was picking winners and picking losers. So the whole moral failure around that was, who's to decide that the people who invested in this contract should get their money back, but, you know, my friend who sent Ether to an invalid address that no one ever will have access to, he doesn't get anything back. And so that was kind of the fundamental thing around it. So, but there was no other solution at the time. So what we're looking at is, we believe that every single contract should be given the option to have a dispute resolution function built into it from the beginning. And that's what we're developing. We're developing a system called SageCoin. And the idea is that we're not looking to be that dispute dispute resolution party. We're just looking to build the infrastructure there. So if you're developing a contract, let's say you're not that good a developer, you're developing a contract and you can't afford to buy some expensive auditing services for it. Well, I need to know that if I'm going to have people use this, that there's some fallback in case something goes wrong. We don't want to remove the decentralization concept from it. So the way it works is you can define a list of people, or even in code as the contract executes, it can change, who have access to trigger a dispute. And there is a dispute resolution vendor who's listed in the contract who would be assigned to handle the dispute. And the idea being that someone who wants to activate the dispute, who's a party to the contract, they don't get to decide where the funds go or anything. They just get to say, hold on a second, something went wrong here. And as soon as they trigger that, then the contract would be frozen and it would go into this dispute resolution behavior where the vendor who is assigned to it would get to kind of figure out what happened, just the way that dispute resolution systems work today with traditional contracts that you know, basically they try to make it fair for all parties, and we're creating a marketplace where dispute resolution vendors can advertise their services. And then you can think about how the reason why we're doing it this way is because dispute resolution, there are other systems out there people are building to do stuff like this, but they're saying, oh, dispute resolution will happen by mob vote or this and that. And since my co-founder is an attorney, she's very comfortable with the idea that dispute resolution is the opposite of a one-size-fits-all system. It really depends. If I'm disputing a Coke that I just bought from a vending machine, that is completely different than if I'm disputing a $100 million contract. And if it's just a Coke from a vending machine, the dispute resolution system should probably be some kind of automated bot that's handling the dispute, and it would happen very quickly with very limited information. But if I'm handling dispute resolution for a $100 million contract, I may even want the person who's handling the dispute or the company to be a known individual that I can go see on TV or something, because their reputation should be on the line. That's a lot of money. You know, they should make sure that they do that well. So we're just building the infrastructure there that would create that capability as part of an SDK that goes into contracts, and then also smart contracts on the Ethereum network that would police and manage that system.
So if we were to pretend that either the Parity wallet or one of these CoinDash hacks, or I don't know which kind of hacks would be well handled by your system. If this whole Parity wallet was built using your technology in the future, for example, mm-hmm. Can you give us an example, or you know, walk us through a use case scenario of how that would have been avoided?
Sure. So Parity is an interesting case. So the fundamental limitation of the network is in a contract, some of the parties or all of the parties may be pseudo-anonymous. So this is the problem with crossing over into traditional law. How can you can't have a court case if you don't know who's in the contract? You can't go to court over it if the identities are unknown. Because who's going to be there to decide who's going to, if you don't know, you can't do it. And the other factor is there's something called enforcement with contracts. So normally what happens is you go to court over something, and when you're done, there is a decision about what's supposed to happen. This person's going to give this person $1 million, whatever. If that happens, then normally that ultimately there's an enforcement there where the person's required, they're compelled to give that money over. And if they don't, there's things you can do to say, I'm going to get this money from this person. Ultimately, someone will show up at your house with a gun and get the money from you. I don't know if that's exactly what will happen, but I mean, the law will compel you to give that money over, freeze your bank account, you know, whatever. There's different systems that I don't know all the details of. I'm not an attorney, by the way. But the problem you have with these pseudo-anonymous systems is once the contract's over, you may not know who that party was at all. So one of the limitations of dispute resolution of smart contracts is it's fundamentally limited to whatever collateralized assets are held by that contract. So something a little bit different than traditional contracts is combined with that a self-executing code are assets. We're talking, you know, Ether that's exchangeable for, you know, real money in any fiat currency. There could be authorized access to other systems on the Ethereum network. There's actually four different types of things that could be in there, or that contract could have control over. And so ultimately, you're limited by what hasn't happened yet, I guess I would say. So if the Parity wallet, the money had already been, well, in this case, no money was drained, it was just frozen. If the shared library that was holding the wallets together was not deleted yet, then our technology would have helped. And so what you'd look at there is, okay, you're writing up a contract, a smart contract, and you're saying, this kill function, which is how the thing got messed up, this kill function is very important. If somebody ends up calling this and they're not the right person to call it and they kill this, it's going to mess up our whole system. So what our SDK allows for is setting up time-locked dispute resolution points. And what the idea there is, if it's something really critical to your system, maybe you should have a time lock around it that essentially you get a notification that says, hey, this code is being called on your smart contract. It's going to execute in 3 days because that's the time lock that you put onto it. So are you sure that you want this to happen? Because if you don't, you have 3 days to dispute the contract, at which point it would go to dispute resolution and this issue would be resolved by the vendor listed. But if you don't do anything, then this contract will be killed in 3 days, essentially. So the idea there is just if there's a key area of your contract, and you may know what it is, because even in the DAO contract or something else, there's only a few points where money could have been extracted. And you know what those are. Even if you're not sure how they could be exploited, you know where the money's going out, which line of code sends the money out. So you could put specific time lock. They're also called speed bumps. Kind of points around that where you could say, hold on a sec, let's give everyone time. And this is very similar. Again, this is an invention of anything new. This already exists in software. It also exists, like, if you look at real estate, there's, you know, escrow when you're buying a property. And that time, although people get annoyed because they're like, oh, it's 30-day escrow, you know what? That time is actually important. It doesn't have to be 30 days, but time is an important factor in contracts. Sometimes you need time to wait for something to settle or just to make sure that everything's okay before moving forward. And so we need to bring that concept into smart contracts. And that's one of the features that our SDK provides. So, I mean, the basic concept around it is just, I think you have to architect your contract and use our SDK, which is, I think, a big hurdle to get people over, obviously. And it's going to take time to establish that in the marketplace and make, you know, people comfortable with it. But we are going to do security audits, and we're going to follow the idea to keep it simple of what we're putting into it. But the bigger picture is that ultimately you could implement it into the Parity wallet such that we could have actually been notified with whatever time lock was desired before this actually took place. And that in that time, we could have stopped it from happening.
Wonderful. I had two questions. One was your friend's example where your friend sent Ethereum to an address that did not exist anymore and it vanished. Mm-hmm. How would that example play out in with your technology?
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, you know, there's some technologies out there. First of all, like I said, we can't stop anything that's already happened because we can't reverse transactions.
That's right.
So the main thing we look at there is, okay, if you're developing a wallet in the future, and there's different types of wallets that people use. So I have, you know, I mean, in real life, I put some of my money in my bank account. I put some in my safe deposit box, let's say, some in my, I have gold in my safe. I'm making this up. I don't have a safe, but if all of those things, you know, I don't store everything in one place. And so I think cryptocurrency is similar, and that's probably good advice. The whole don't put all your eggs in one basket thing is good advice in general, and it definitely applies to cryptocurrency for the reasons that we've seen. But, you know, ultimately, there could be a wallet if it's a significant amount of money that has a delay. In fact, you know, the other day I sent money out of my Coinbase account, and it was, I was sending an Ether, one Ether somewhere, and they said, oh, it's going to be 72 hours. We're going to hold it as a security measure. Well, they're basically employing this speed bump kind of concept around it. And that was annoying to me, but I totally understand why they're doing it because, you know, I don't know, they saw something on my account that they thought maybe I got hacked or whatever. Something in their system triggered the idea that, well, if we just wait 3 days and we notify him by email, then ultimately there's time for him to see this email, say, wait, I didn't do that, and then go in and notify them, et cetera. So I think with any wallet, you could have that kind of feature. But again, there's a lot of user responsibility because you'd have to use the right wallet and know that you want to be in that situation ultimately.
Right. So timing, giving more time seems to be a key feature, you would say. Just giving people time to think, you know.
Yeah, it's a funny concept because ultimately everything, you know, when I first got into cryptocurrency, I was consulting on a real estate project and they're like, oh, we want to speed up escrow using like, you know, multi-signature Bitcoin wallet. And I mean, I think that's an interesting idea, but ultimately we have to go back to why does the time escrow exist for real estate? And is that really because the money can't be sent that fast as a wire transfer? Or is it some other reason why we're waiting? You know, and so the similar things apply here. We're always concerned, oh, Bitcoin transactions, there's a backlog and it's going to take a long time. And for certain things, definitely we want it to happen faster. But Bitcoin's thrived in spite of long delays in sending transactions right now that we're seeing on the network because fundamentally people aren't using it for instant things. They're using it for a store of value and they don't care if it takes a day. They're in fact used to that. Their bank already gotten them used to the fact that if you want to send money to another bank, it's going to take 3 days. So there's nothing new here and there's nothing to complain about. But ultimately that time is actually important in some cases to know that I could lose my money instantaneously and have no way to get it back. It could be a bad thing in some situations.
What about once your technology is rolled out, is it possible for a malicious buyer after he got his stuff to kind of initiate a dispute? I know it's unethical, but how do you stop that?
Right. So that's something we've looked at that a lot. We've looked at that a lot. We actually talk about in our white paper about DDoS attacks that can happen on contracts through, not even DDoS, just DOS attacks that can happen using the dispute resolution function. If I'm irritated with, so ultimately, yes, we're going to have to publish very specific instructions about how you should use this. And we've put in some different behaviors that can help mitigate these types of situations. For example, you know, ENS is a really big smart contract that's commonly used on the Ethereum blockchain right now. It's the Ethereum name service. You can actually kind of register for a domain using it, but it's decentralized. If somebody used our system, you know, if that contract used our system and anyone who had registered a domain could dispute the contract, well, that would be a bad thing because that means that anyone could go register for a domain and then make themselves one of the members of the contract and then just go dispute it and basically crash the whole system. So, you know, you have to look at each contract and say, well, what kind of controls do we want to put over this? In that case, I could see, you know, it is somewhat centralizing, but let's put a public council of people who everybody knows and, you know, 12 known people. And ultimately, if the system goes awry, they have the power to trigger a dispute. Because remember, they don't have the power to individually change the outcomes of the system, even when they send it to dispute. And then obviously who the party is who's in charge of the dispute resolution would probably want to be someone very public that, you know, for example, I look at Andreas Antonopoulos. He's worked a lot in the crypto space and he's also interested in law. You know, he has a company that has, I think, an attorney on board. And they've talked a lot about dispute resolution as well. But if he was his company was running dispute resolution services, let's say, then I'd feel pretty comfortable sending that contract to dispute because he's got a lot of reputation stake on the line to get that right.
It's almost like trial by jury, it sounds like, but I don't know how exactly it'll be implemented. I had two questions because as we start winding down, given the time, one of the questions is, what is your timeline for rolling out your technology, etc.? And the second question is, who should be thinking about you and your Bootstrap Legal? Who should be coming to you and when, right?
Right. Yeah, let me talk about the project a little bit. So, I mean, the project was birthed out of a meeting of the minds between computer science and attorneys who, you know, specialize in the kind of things that are important to making this happen. And it's not a solution that came to us overnight. We spent a lot of time just trying to grok what a smart contract is and how intent plays into that and how we can make it better and solve the issues around it. So we're looking at the first software phase will be completed in January of next year. And that's the initial kind of prototype of showing the technology in action. But full-scale rollout of the system is roughly around a year from now. We have a roadmap that shows when that is. So, I mean, we're still very early. This is an infrastructure project because fundamentally we're building something that's decentralized that we won't control in the long run. And that's our goal anyway. And we just want it to be something the community can use. We're creating an economic model around it that we think is valuable with the coins, which we haven't really talked about. But so we're looking at a year. And then I think for us, you know, obviously we're just very aware that getting people on board with it is the important part of the system and contract writers on board. So I think there's a lot of angles we can hit for that. And then I also think we can build some of our own proof of concept products that show people how it could be used because there's a lot of cool uses for it that people haven't really considered yet, where you kind of blend the idea of a smart contract with a traditional contract and create somewhat of a hybrid. So
great. And my other question about who should be coming to you and when? How do they know that they need your technology?
I think anyone who's writing smart contracts should definitely consider us at this point and start talking to us about it. And we'd love to talk to you, obviously. Specifically, if you're writing code and you're not going to be getting it audited, even if you are, because the DAO contract was audited, but more, you know, the thing is we're going to have a small amount of code. It's going to be audited. So if you're doing a bigger contract and you're not going to do an audit, then you might want some safeguards around it just to protect yourself. And code audits are expensive. So I think there's that part of it, but also anyone who's interested, they should contact us because we're, you know, we'd love to get more people involved in the project. And that's definitely the direction we're headed as a company. And yeah. So even if you're not a programmer, you're just interested in it, you have another skill, we'd love to hear from you.
Dan, that's super fundamental. You're talking about anybody that's writing a smart contract, essentially, because you're looking at the roots of this whole blockchain concept.
Yeah, we're trying to be very generic, and that's what I think differentiates us, like I said, from the other dispute resolution systems in the space is, very generic solution. We aren't advertising that we're going to be resolving disputes. We're just creating infrastructure around it to help other people be those vendors and create a long-term marketplace.
That is fantastic. Well, I'm sure we will have one of the uniqueness or unique features of Kryptonites is we have several of our guest speakers come back because we just touched upon in a very, very exciting, and there were 10 other topics of interest that you didn't have a chance to explain here because of the lack of time.
Absolutely. So
we'll certainly look forward to having you back as a regular speaker here once in a while, coming back and helping our audience understand about your progress over the next year.
Yeah, I'd love to give an update about where things are going. I mean, one of the things we're building into our ICO is just time-locked deadlines to get things done. And if we don't meet those, then we have to refund the ICO participants. So, I mean, it's something that, you know, we'll definitely be making progress on this. And yeah, it's a long-term project, really.
Your skin is in the game. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Crypto Knights. Never miss an episode. Subscribe now at www.cryptonights.io.